you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
I wanted the audience to think about these issues from a slightly different point of view and make them think about some of the deeper themes that were happening in the society, but give them the distance from it that science fiction provides, to call them Cylons instead of Al-Qaeda. You know, it's not the Republicans and the Democrats. Here's an opportunity to separate yourself from all the tribalism of day-to-day life and think about, what if the shoe is on the other foot? All these sorts of questions that you could ask in a science fiction format and get away with it.
This is Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, a love letter to science fiction and the fans and creators who made it so, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. I'm Adam Savage, and you're about to hear my cosmically charged and wonderfully inspiring conversation with someone who grew up with a poster of Captain Kirk in their childhood bedroom and later went on to be a writer and producer on Star Trek himself, Ron Moore. For nearly three decades, Ron has been a driving force in the world of science fiction. He began his career writing on Star Trek The Next Generation, boldly taking the franchise even further into the unknown. He went on to be both a writer and producer on Star Trek First Contact, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. Ron has also famously developed the Battlestar Galactica reboot and its spin-off, Caprica. These days, Ron brings his creative vision to the popular time-traveling series, Outlander. Ron and I get things started discussing how the NASA space program fueled his early love of science fiction, and how he went from attending Star Trek conventions as a fan to attending them as a star attraction. Ron is one of us, a fan. Here we go. Ron Moore, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So clearly you're a sci-fi fan from way back. Do you have an earliest sci-fi memory?
I came to science fiction through the space program. I'm old enough to remember the Apollo 11 moon landing. I was like 5 years old, 4.5 years old, something like that. My parents gathering us in the living room and watching it on TV and then being told that was happening on the moon, that I could look up outside. And I was really captivated by that. So then I started watching all the moon landings and launches, and I became obsessed with spaceships and rockets. It was a quick step from there to look for TV shows that had spaceships in it. Right. And the first one I watched was Lost in Space. I loved the show when I was like in the second and third grades.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dr. Smith and the robot and the spaceship, and I would draw pictures of the Jupiter 2 and try to figure out where all the different things were on the inside.
You do your own blueprints.
I did my own little blueprints. We're talking the early 70s. Mm-hmm. So I watched it every day after school. And then at some point, I started watching Star Trek, and that literally changed my life. I was like, just walked away from Lost in Space. It's like, this doesn't even make sense. And then Star Trek became my personal, like, obsession to this very day.
Do you have an insight as to the fundamental difference between Lost in Space and Star Trek?
Yeah, Star Trek took it seriously.
Right.
Star Trek really believed in what it was doing. It tried to maintain a certain consistency in the universe. It was about big ideas. And, you know, the characters within the show believed it. And I was very attracted to a place that really existed. As a kid, I mean, I had those, is there really a spaceship? You know, do they really film in space like the Apollo 11s? You know, I mean, I couldn't quite sort those things out at that age. But I believed in it.
You ended up working on Star Trek Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
Still fairly young. What is the evolution that got you from fan all the way to working on it?
Essentially what happened was, I was at Cornell University studying government on a Navy ROTC scholarship. I was in my senior year. A former roommate of mine came back for a visit to school. We spent a long weekend together hanging out at our old haunts. And he said, well, what are you going to do with your life? I said, I have no idea. And he said, why don't you come back to California with me and be a writer? He knew I liked to write, and I was part of a literary society with him. It's how we knew each other. But I had never really taken it seriously that that was a career. You know, mm-hmm. You grew up in Chowchilla. There are no writers. It's not a real job.
Yeah.
It's like a pretend job. So I never seriously considered making that a vocation until suddenly I had nothing else. So literally cashed out my bank account, bought a one-way ticket to LA, and started sleeping on Eric's floor in Studio City, and just started over, you know. Got a job as a messenger. I worked at an animal hospital. I did personnel. I just, you know, futzed around LA for about 3 years, taking various odd jobs. I would start and stop spec scripts with varying degrees of discipline. And then Next Generation got made, and I was like, oh, my God, it'd be amazing to write for that show. But I still had no real path in or prospect for it. Show came on. I was watching it. I was taping it on VHS. Ask your parents. And, you know, and essentially what happened was I started dating this girl who had a connection to the show just by happenstance. And she had worked on the pilot in the casting department. And she said, well, I know you're a Star Trek fan, hence the Captain Kirk poster in your apartment.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I could get you a tour of the sets. Because there were so many people in those days that wanted to see the Star Trek sets that the powers that be had finally said, this is crazy. We're going to have one tour a week. It'll be an official tour. And if you can get on the list, it's not open to the public, but it's all the agents and actors and various peoples that want to go see the sets. This will be the day they go. So she made a call and said, okay, I got you on the tour. It's in about 6 weeks. I was like, oh, my God, it's amazing. And I just decided, in my own hubris, I said, I'm going to write an episode and take it with me. And sat down over those 6 weeks and wrote an episode called The Bonding. And tucked it under my arm and took it with me on the set tour. And managed to con the guy, Richard Arnold was his name, who was giving the set tour, into reading it. He kind of liked me. At first, he was like, you know, I can't really do that. But I kept at him. I was juggling the joy of being on the set with also trying to work Richard to read my script. And eventually, he said, okay, I'll read it. And he did. And he liked it. And he turned out to be one of Gene Roddenberry's assistants. And so Richard gave the script to the woman that became my first agent. She submitted it to the show. It sat in the slush pile for about 7 months. A new executive producer named Michael Piller, the late Michael Piller, came aboard at the beginning of the third season, started going through the slush pile, found my script. And I get this call one day that they want to buy it and produce it. And would I pitch another? And I go in and I pitch another one. One of those got bought and became The Defector. And then got another call a few weeks later. Michael said, I just let a staff writer go. Could you show up tomorrow? And I was like, yeah. And I did. And I was there for the next 10 years. And that's how my career started. I was incredibly fortunate. It was like the universe just kind of allowed something miraculous to happen for me.
Amazing. What do you think about sci-fi in general and Star Trek specifically that has such deep cultural resonance?
I think for Star Trek, there were a lot of things about that particular show that transcended the usual. First and foremost, it was this optimistic idea of the future. And most science fiction generally paints a very dystopian view of the future. And Star Trek was the one property that basically said, hey, you know what? It's going to be okay. We're going to work all this shit out.
Yeah.
It's racism, war, poverty, international strife, all that's going to go away. We're going to move out into the universe in a positive sense, and it's going to be a projection of American values. It's going to be a democratic system. It's going to be tolerant. It's going to be all the best parts of our country that we want to believe in. We're going to go out, and then we're going to have these amazing adventures. And that was an incredibly seductive and attractive idea for people for generations now, and still is. Science fiction overall, you know, it's just a big what if. It really stretches the boundaries of your imagination. Most drama is just centered around the life that you know and what can happen with people you know. Well, science fiction takes all of that and really changes it. What if the planet was different? What if the society evolved differently? What if Hitler never died? What if, you know, all kinds of what ifs? What if technology goes down this path? What if you were living on another planet in the distant future? And it really just broadens your imagination and you just lose yourself in these real fantasy worlds that literally anything is possible. And that's a very seductive idea.
Is it inherent in the genre of science fiction to allow that sort of subject matter to be explored?
I think part of it is, you know, you're building a world. So as a writer, you're creating a world that doesn't exist. So you start asking yourself some of these fairly fundamental questions. Okay, what is this government like in this piece I'm writing? Is it a good government? Is it a bad government? How has it changed? You know, what's the basis that the society is organized on? What are the prejudices within this society? What are the positive aspects? How is it different from the way we interact with each other? So right from the get-go, you're asking yourself fairly interesting political ideas that then become baked into the piece. And as a writer, you're always seeking out conflict and drama, and you quickly start realizing, ooh, this is interesting. This is so different from the way we do things, or this is a comment on what we do today. What if I change up, you know, the expectation? What if we're the suicide bombers? Ooh, right. That's challenging. Yeah. I want to write that, you know? So you're kind of drawn to these sort of political ideas within the science fiction universe because it kind of sets itself up in a way that you want to explore those things. I grew up in an environment where television and the movies of the era were dealing with those things head on. And people had various opinions about what the characters did, but it just seemed like that's what you did with this medium. There were programs that challenged me as well as entertained me.
Absolutely. And you got to tackle a lot of what-ifs when you were asked to reboot Battlestar Galactica. How did you go about turning it into something so completely different?
You know, I'd seen it in its original run. Mm-hmm. And liked it as a kid, but, you know, it wasn't Star Trek. Nothing was. And it wasn't Star Wars either. It kind of was trying to be both, and it was ABC TV in the 70s, so it just kind of fell in between a lot of stools. But when I was approached to reboot it, it was just a couple of months after the 9/11 attacks. And I hadn't seen it in a good 20 years and remembered it, but wanted to kind of refresh my memory. And when you're watching it in that moment in time, it's hard not to be struck by the resonance,
right.
You know, emotionally.
Right.
Like, wow, this is about an apocalyptic attack out of the blue that destroys an entire culture, and then the enemies pursue the few survivors into the night. And I realized just immediately watching it going, wow, if you do this today, this is going to have a completely different impact on the audience than it did originally. And here's an opportunity to do a show that's really about us and about the moment that we're in, and to do a show about the war against terror, to do a show that was about ideas like civilian control of the military in a time of war, liberty versus security, terrorism, fundamentalism, religious strife, all these things suddenly could be put into this crucible of this show, that I just said, yeah, let's do it. This is a great opportunity.
Were you using the genre of sci-fi as a way to get some of these very political ideas that the show brings to fore past the audience's filters?
Yes. It was deliberate. I was like, I want to talk about today. And I wanted to talk about it in a different way than, say, Star Trek did. Because Star Trek's format was, it's a morality play. Each week, the Enterprise is going to pull up to a planet, and here's going to be an interesting ethical moral dilemma. And by the end of the show, the captain's going to basically tell you what the right answer is.
Right.
And that's basically the concept. I wanted Galactica to be a show that raised a lot of questions and didn't really have good answers, because I felt that's the world I live in. And I wanted the audience to think about these issues from a slightly different point of view and to put them into uncomfortable situations, make them think about some of the deeper themes that we were examining and the different ideas culturally, politically, morally that were happening in the society, but give them the distance from it that science fiction provides, to call them Cylons instead of Al-Qaeda, you know, to make them colonials and, you know, Laura Roslin. They're not, it's not George W. Bush, and it's not the Republicans and the Democrats. Here's an opportunity to separate yourself from all the tribalism of, you know, day-to-day life and think about some of these other things. What if the shoe was on the other foot? What if, you know, what if the monotheists are the bad guys? What if the pagans are the good guys? You know, all these sorts of questions that you could ask in a science fiction format and get away with it.
Can you walk me through the evolution of you as a storyteller from the spec scripts for Star Trek through Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, the movies, and Battlestar Galactica?
Well, you know, Next Gen was really like undergraduate school. Everyone had so much more experience than I did, and I was the youngest person on the staff. And I was the only, like, true fan, quote-unquote,
oh,
on
wow.
the staff. I mean, they were fans of the show
yeah.
as people, as adults. They loved it. But I was the only one who had actually gone to a Star Trek convention and,
oh,
collected,
wow.
and collected the books. You know, I was the fan on the staff. So for 5 years I was on Next Gen, it was about learning television. It was about learning my craft as a writer. It was about learning television production in all the ways that, you know, that it's done. Not realizing at that point what a unique environment Star Trek was. You
yeah.
know, many years later when I left the show, I discovered, wow, that was a bubble. You know, no shows run like Star Trek. That was like a very unique
really?
Situation I was in. Yeah. But Next Gen was very much just about learning, moving up the ladder, understanding how production works, budgets, schedules, how to write a show you know, when you've got problems, how to rewrite fast, all those kinds of things. Then when I went to Deep Space, it was like graduate school because now I learned all that. Now we were going to push the show and push the format of Star Trek further and be more challenging and get deeper into characters and more morally ambiguous stories, do more continuing stories, which Trek hadn't really done before that. So that by the time I left the show, I had really taken on so much learning and I learned so much about the business and the craft of writing and producing. It was like I was a different person at the end of that.
I interviewed Jonathan Frakes as part of this, and I know a few of the cast members from Next Generation. One of the connections I've seen, also knowing some of your cast members from Battlestar Galactica, is that when you described Star Trek as like a bubble, I've noticed how deeply a family that show really was. Yeah. And it seems to come right from Gene on down. But those actors and so many people worked on that are still in deep touch with each other, still close friends. And I've noticed a similar thing to the cast of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. I mean, I approached Battlestar wanting to recreate that aspect of it, that we're all in this together and it's a family and you try to give everyone ownership of the show from the grips to the visual effects guys to the writers and the cast, that we're all doing this thing. But you can only do so much. It's either going to happen or it's not. And on Battlestar, it did. It just, we all became family and we all really believed in what we were doing and loved it. And we were just, there were a lot of times where the ratings were so-so or the network was giving us a hard time. And we just sort of console each other by saying, you know, they'll love us someday. Someday they'll look back on the show and say, they did good work, you know, and we just didn't care. We were like, we're still going to make this. And yeah, that family atmosphere absolutely happened on Battlestar.
And it showed in the work. It's hard, I imagine, because science fiction still gets less respect than the other more, quote, literary genres. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's this weird, it's almost part of the anti-intellectualism of the society as well. It's not to be taken seriously. It's kid stuff. And yet, I'm going to go pay my ticket for it and see it over and over again. It's my favorite thing in the world. It's this weird kind of, the eggheads and the nerds and the geeks make that stuff and they obsess and get all, they all talk about the warp drive and it's so stupid. And yet you'll go watch the show and enjoy it. So it's a weird, I don't know, I'd be curious to know if there's this same kind of split in other countries like this one where there is this weird thing about science fiction and fantasy, for that matter, you know, being looked down upon officially and yet completely embraced commercially.
I don't quite understand it because clearly it's very important to us culturally.
Clearly it is. This is where, you know, it's the expressions of our fantasies and our hopes, you know. It's the superhero boom has really supplanted, you know, the Western in a lot, large sense. So is science fiction. And the Western used to be so big in this country for decades. It was the embodiment of everything in the American psyche, that we could look back to this time and do a variety of stories and a variety of settings and felt, and we would watch them every week. There were so many Westerns on the air in the 50s. It's staggering, and how many movies they did. And then that all kind of comes to an end. But what replaces it is sort of science fiction and fantasy, and then the superhero boom. And it's still about the audience wants to lose themselves in this other world that's not part of their day-to-day world, where they can project themselves in this other setting. And it's just, it's an interesting transition.
Super broad, but if you had to define it, what is science fiction and fantasy, for that matter? What does it mean to you as a person and as a creator?
I guess for me, science fiction implies an alternate world where certain technological or societal changes have happened, but there's a consistency and a logic to it. You know, it's grounded in real science and for the most part, and grounded in real ideas about politics and humanity. Fantasy introduces magic and things that can't exist, dragons and literal magic and those sorts of elements. You know, Lord of the Rings, it's still grounded within its own universe. Right. There's rules within its universe, but the rules are not, you know, they're not connected to natural law and sort of our ideas of science. There's kind of a dividing line between the two.
What would 10-year-old youth have thought of 2017? How much does this match or exceed your expectations about what the future would be like?
I think I would be astonished at computers and the internet And the idea that I can take this black piece of plastic and glass out of my pocket and watch a television show on it.
Yeah.
Even Star Trek didn't do that. You know, in Star Trek, the communicator was a big thing.
Right.
You flopped it open and you could, it was just a radio. It was like a telephone. That was kind of astonishing in its day. But the idea that you could actually watch things on it and they would have more computing power in my pocket than the entire Apollo space program would have blown my mind. I would be wildly disappointed to realize that we didn't go into space, that the moon missions were really it, that the space shuttle, it was sold as an interim step, like, oh, we're going to do this like space truck for a few years, and then we're going to go to Mars, and it's going to get really cool. And that we just lost interest, and the political will to do it faded with the end of the space race. And that would have broken my heart as a kid, because I invested a lot in the idea that we were on a path that was going to take us to Star Trek. Like, I may not see a Starship Enterprise, but I was certainly going to live in a world where people went to Mars and colonies were started and there were lots of space stations and maybe even I could go there someday as an adult. So that would have really bothered me.
Do you see yourself as a creator, someone who's helping to push that cultural debate and push us in the right direction?
I try to. You know, I mean, I think that in what I work on, I always find myself trying to be hopeful about people and even bad people, you know, and that the human beings are fundamentally good creatures and that we all have sparks of humanity and sparks of hope in us. And that was very much what we talked about in Battlestar. You know, eventually the Cylons became more understandable and we started to realize their good and bad points just as the human characters had good and bad points.
Since you and I were kids, technology has gone through multiple iterations of making storytelling so much more possible. Where do you fall on the CG versus practical effects? Do you think it's often stated there's almost too much computer-generated imagery in movies today? Where do you fall on this debate?
I think it's an amazing tool. I mean, it's really revolutionized the business, and I've seen that happen. The things where we were able to do at Star Trek versus what we could do at Battlestar is amazing. You know, Star Trek, it was all models and blue screen, and there was nothing to talk about in prep. I mean, they didn't really even have any storyboards. You would just kind of talk about what the shot you wanted to have happen, and then much later they would shoot the models, and it was a very long process, and it was a very expensive process. By the time Battlestar came along, now everything's going CGI. And over the course of Battlestar, we just were able to generate so many more shots per episode, and the cost kept going down, 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 that it was an amazing thing. It's an amazing tool. I think that where people get into trouble is they lean on it to the exclusion of everything else. If you can do it practically, if you can do it in camera, it's usually going to look better because it feels more real to the audience. The audience has an intuitive sense, I think, of what's practical and what's not.
Yeah.
You know, in Battlestar, I said, when we're doing the space shots, I want them to feel handheld, like a guy had to hang out the side of a Raptor with a camera and shoot these things. So he's going to lose focus. He's going to have trouble getting in frame. We're going to lock a camera on the wing of a Viper. We're going to do all these things that pretend like this was all shot by real people because the audience knows fundamentally none of this is real. But if you can fool them into sort of believing that somebody actually went out and shot this innately in unreal object, they start to give themselves over to believing it. I think a lot of things fall down for me when I'm watching the big 360 sweeping shot that goes around an object and a camera pulls way back or like swoops down through the city and down into the street and then into the building and around the corner. Okay, I know that's not real.
Right.
And the audience on some basic level does too. They know that you can't really get a camera to do that and they know that this shot is not possible. So as soon as that instinctive knowledge takes over in your head, you kind of separate yourself. You're kind of like, okay, this is all visual effects. This isn't real. But when you're watching something like Mad Max or Baby Driver, it's clear that the limitations of where you can put a camera are on a practical street or on a practical vehicle lock you into certain angles and certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And you start believing that, wow, this is a real car. That's a real truck. And you get a little excited. It's more dangerous. It's like people actually went out there and did this, and you start believing in the drama even more.
So this leads to the most modern technology that's happening with storytelling right now, which is augmented reality and virtual reality. Obviously, storytelling is moving into these mediums. What do you think about that?
I'm a big supporter of the idea that VR has a big future in storytelling. I saw a demo of the PlayStation VR sets a couple of years ago before they were released, and I was blown away, primarily by one demonstration where they had had a piece that was, there was a movie that came out a while back called The Walk that was about the tightrope walker who walked between the Twin Towers. Well, they had a demo of that was based on that for VR. And
I did that demo.
Did you?
Yeah.
You put on the headset, you stand, they had me stand on a little piece of wood, and they had taped down a rope on the carpet.
Yeah.
So you put it on, and suddenly it fade in, and you're standing on the corner of the World Trade Center, and my heart started beating.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. And the sense of really being in that place was profound. And when they said, okay, step out, feel down with your foot where the rope is, now step out onto the tightrope, I couldn't do it.
Hmm.
I started to, and I got really weirded out and scared, and I'm like, what am I doing here? This is crazy. I know I'm in this room.
Yeah.
I wrote Star Trek. I get this whole concept. This is nothing new. Here's the carpet. I haven't been magically transported away. But it was such a powerful tool to tell all of my senses that I was really in a different place. I was not in that room. I was really standing on the World Trade Center. And as I played around with other VR demos and sets, I just realized if you could convince an audience that they were truly somewhere else, that's a leap of entertainment, I think, potentially as big as, like, the coming of sound. It really changes your perception of the drama. Now, how we do that, how we deliver that drama is a separate question. But I do think that as I look at VR, to me, there's a big, bright line that I think a lot of people ignore between a game and a narrative. I think anything that asks you to interact is a game, just by another name. If you're going to knock over a lamp and somebody's going to react to you, or if you have a choice to walk through that door or to do anything in the space, it's a game. If all you have to do is observe and have the story told to you, that's narrative. And right now we're at a place where everyone just wants it interactive. And it's hard. I keep trying to convince people, let's do narrative. Let's do just a story where all I'm asking from you, the viewer, is just sit on your couch, put this headset on, and you're going to fade into the opening scene of The Godfather. You're going to sit in The Godfather's office next to his desk, and it's going to happen around you. And it's like taking the audience and putting them up on the stage during a theatrical performance. And then I'm going to, like, take you outside, and the wedding scene with everyone dancing and singing is going to happen around you. And you're not a person. You're not a ghost. You're not the butler. You're just like an omniscient observer. And I think no one is really going there very well yet, and people just keep getting drawn into interactivity. But I think there's a huge chunk of the audience that just wants to be told a story.
Right.
They don't want to participate in it. They don't want to make choices. They don't want to do the make-your-own-adventure tale. They just want to be told a story. And here's a brand new medium in which to do that. And how we do that and how those stories develop and how the technology can catch up, all that's still to be figured out. It's the Wild West. All these cameras are still being changed and tested, and there's no one standard. So it's all just trying to figure out how you do it.
Well, I mean, I think about the history of film, how even something like the reverse angle or the Eisenstein steps was radical for the time that we invented this language over decades.
Yeah. And right now it's sort of like we've invented sound and everybody just wants to watch movies with explosions in them. They hear the sound.
Right.
It's like, let's just watch things blow up. I just want to have things that blow up a lot because that's what's – isn't that why I'm listening? I just want sound. More noise, more noise, more noise. Well, yeah, but what about other things that sound is helping you experience the drama, but it doesn't have to just all be like, you know, bells and whistles.
True, but with all the noise, how do you get people to hear the bigger issues beneath the explosions?
I think it's good to make people question things. I think it's easy for people to sort of lull themselves into apathy and just not care and just sort of allow society and the world around them to proceed along its arc and not question what's going on or, you know. And I guess I have a love of history, and I always look back, and it's you're always astounded by, wow, why didn't they see that back then? You know, how could we have these great civil rights debates in the 60s? What, are you kidding? This is a debate? How could people think that Nazi Germany could be okay? You have this moral hindsight, and then you sort of say, well, wait a minute. What is the world I'm living in now, and why aren't we questioning certain things? And so it feels like your obligation – if you have an obligation as an artist, and I'm not sure you do, but if you do, one of those should be to – challenge people, to make them think about the world they live in, to sort of, you know, bring up the great moral ideas of the age.
Do you feel like we're in a new golden age of science fiction?
I do. I mean, it's really amazing. I feel like a lot of it just has to do with the technology. CG has allowed us to do things that we could never have dreamed of watching back in the 70s and the 80s. today we're able to do astounding things. I mean, the Marvel Universe and what they do visually is just breathtaking. I mean, it's really something. You really believe that all these things are really happening. And that has just opened up science fiction. But the technology has just allowed us to really, like, create these worlds that could not possibly have existed before.
Where do you fall on the Turing debate? Do you think if the machine sufficiently fools us into thinking that it's sentient, that it is?
I think it probably is by that definition. To me, a bigger question is, does it have a soul? Is it something that we think of ourselves as having? Whether it's sentient or not is almost a separate question to me. It can be sentient and not have a soul, or sentient and not have a part of itself that we would consider spiritual or something greater than what we seem. Because I guess while I'm sort of agnostic generally and religiously, there is a part of me that deeply wants to believe there is something greater, that wants to believe I am not just made of this, not just flesh, you know, or whatever Yoda says that I can't quote correctly at the moment. But that wants to believe that. It wants to believe there's something that transcends the world that I see around me. So would an artificial being evolve to that state is an interesting question, and one that ultimately really can't be answered, because how could you ever know that?
Before I let you go, I have a lightning round of some either-or questions to pepper you with. Here we go. Time travel back or time travel forward?
Back.
Space opera or soap opera?
Space opera.
End up a zombie or end up a ghost?
A ghost.
Roswell or the Bermuda Triangle?
Roswell.
Cyberpunk or steampunk?
Steampunk.
Early adopter or Luddite?
Early adopter.
Isaac Asimov or Isaac Newton?
Asimov.
Battlestar or Starship?
Starship.
Fascinating. Ron, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks to Ron Moore, and thanks again for listening to Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. If you like this, be sure to check out our other episodes with wonderful guests like Neil Gaiman, Rick Baker, Doug Chang, and Jonathan Frakes. For more about the podcast, visit us at sci-fi.com.